From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, if you're having a tough time figuring out how Obamacare could work for you, help is on the way in the form of an ACA navigator.
The navigator is essentially there to kind of hold your hand and answer your questions and make sure you can navigate successfullyhealthcare.gov and get yourself or your small business enrolled.
Art or music lessons when you're young can have a big payoff years later.
Those that were inventors, started a business, generated a patent, we found that they were more likely to have been engaged in the arts through their lifespan.
Plus, Detroit's mayor-elect, the governor, and the emergency manager. How will they work together?
Across all these different offices, if you will, there's a lot of mutual respect.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Well, any day now, there will be a decision from Judge Stephen Rhodes on whether to authorize Detroit's Chapter 9 bankruptcy. And everyone paying attention to this historic ruling is wondering, what will the verdict be? But here's another question for you to ponder. What will it take to keep other cities and towns across Michigan safe from municipal bankruptcy? Later in the program, we talk with an expert who says he has the solution. Then, after 40 years, when many other cultural institutions have been forced to shut their doors, the Michigan Opera Theater remains one of the most vibrant regional opera companies in the nation. We speak with the MOT's founder about the challenges that lie ahead. But first, whatever your political or social views about the Affordable Care Act, these things are true. It is here. There are people who have no health insurance who need it badly. And the rollout has been, to put it kindly, a disaster. With the terrible performance of the healthcare.gov website and then all the natural confusion that comes with breaking new ground, it's small wonder many people don't even know where to begin to seek coverage under the ACA. Enter my next guest. Don Hazard is the director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare. It's one of four navigator agencies in our state for Obamacare. Don, we've heard this term navigator. Tell us, what can a navigator do and not do?
One ACA navigator is there to assist consumers in making their own enrollment decisions. So a navigator is not an insurance agent. A navigator is not going to tell you what plan to select. But a navigator is there to assist you at no charge to you in figuring out what's best for you and your family or your small business. A navigator is also trained to assist small businesses in getting enrolled in coverage through healthcare.gov. And navigators are not allowed to steer people towards products. They're not allowed to have conflicts of interest, so no navigator agency is going to have any kind of business relationship or financial relationship with an insurance company. And the navigator is essentially there to kind of hold your hand and answer your questions and make sure you can navigate successfullyhealthcare.gov and get yourself or your small business enrolled.
So I can only imagine that the last few weeks with trying to get this troubled website off the ground, it's really meant a lot of headaches for you and for the people who come to you seeking some answers on healthcare coverage.
Well, there's no question about that. It's certainly not ideal to have the enrollment tool not working. But part of the job of a navigator is not just enrolling people in coverage or assisting people in getting themselves enrolled, but also getting out into the community and explaining how all of this works and all the new plans that are available and how the copays and deductibles work and tax credits work and tax subsidies. And, of course, we assist consumers in their attempts to get enrolled. It's a much more complicated process because the website isn't working properly, but we're being told by the federal government that those issues will be resolved soon. And we are seeing anecdotal evidence that the website is being fixed over time. So we've been focusing on paper applications, letting people fill out paper applications to begin that process. It doesn't end the process, but it begins the process in that it gets the government working on doing a determination on your eligibility for a tax credit or a tax subsidy. But again, that doesn't resolve the whole process. The person just gets a determination letter in the mail telling them what they're eligible for, and then they have to go back to the website and make a selection. So not ideal, much longer than necessary. But again, there are hopeful signs. We are seeing signs that the website is actually starting to work properly.
How do people find a navigator?
Well, there are four navigator agencies in Michigan, but our agency is the only statewide navigator. So we have created a statewide network that we're calling Enroll Michigan, and we've created a website called enrollmichigan.com. So essentially it's one-stop shopping for any consumer anywhere in the state trying to find a navigator that can assist them in answering their questions and helping them get enrolled. at no cost to them. There's other types of assisters called certified application counselors that are also out there. They might be more local to you than a navigator, depending where you live. You might be in a rural area. So those are available as well, and you can also access those at enrollmichigan.com.
Don, what questions are you getting from consumers? I have to imagine question A is, how much is this going to cost me?
Yeah, well, obviously consumers are very concerned about cost and affordability, and as they should be. You know, we try to stress that if you're under 400% of the federal poverty limit, there are lots of tax credits and tax subsidies available to make purchasing insurance more affordable, particularly if you're under 200% of the federal poverty limit, because there's cost-sharing subsidies available as well. So that means there's a lot of support out there to make purchasing insurance more affordable. So you shouldn't be frightened off by the sticker price. You know, you see a sticker price on a policy and you think, gee, I can't afford that. Well, that's before you apply all the tax credits and subsidies. And at 400% of the federal poverty limit, for a family of four, that's $94,200 adjusted gross income. So that's basically a six-figure salary before you apply all your tax deductions come tax time. So that's a big chunk of the American middle class that's going to be eligible for tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies. So it's really important that you understand the big picture. Don't get hit with a sticker shock if you see a monthly premium you can't afford. If you're below 400% of the federal poverty limit, odds are you're going to be receiving assistance. It could be substantial assistance to make purchasing that plan affordable to you.
There's no clear-cut answer when someone says, how much does it cost? Because there's so many variables that determine what that sticker price might be, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what's encouraging, very encouraging, is we have lots of competition in this state. We've got 13 different insurance companies selling plans on our marketplace, healthcare.gov. So that's exciting. That's a lot of competition, a lot of transparent competition. So the average person here in Michigan is going to have 42 different healthcare plans to choose from. So when they go to healthcare.gov, they're going to have lots of options to look at. You know, some people are saying, well, there's lots of plans with these really high deductibles. Yeah, and there's lots of plans with no deductibles and lots of plans with medium deductibles. And then really it's about consumer choice and figuring out what's right for you.
When I see the report from Health and Human Services that of the first month of the ACA rollout, and we see only 1,329 people in Michigan actually got enrolled, mm-hmm. are we going to be able to get everybody in by March, or do you think there needs to be an extension?
Well, again, it comes down to getting the enrollment tool fixed. It's really not an issue. It's not a case that people don't want to be enrolled in coverage. It's that they literally can't get themselves enrolled. And a lot of the folks that are getting enrolled are doing so because they're just really determined and they keep their head down and they're determined. And some of them go onto the website at midnight or 3 o'clock in the morning hoping to get themselves enrolled and they have some success. That's not the way to run a railroad. We all know that. The president has apologized. I think everybody involved in that process has apologized. We need to do a lot better than that. So if the website is up and running come December 1, hopefully we will have sufficient time to get everyone enrolled. I think there are going to have to be some policy decisions made as far as maybe extending deadlines if they can't get that website up and running properly.
Yes.
Very soon, but of course that's not a decision I get to make.
Well, Don, one of the big criticisms about the healthcare.gov, apart from the fact that it didn't work, was you had to get all registered before you could shop. If I go to Travelocity, I can price my flights right out of the gate before I sign up and register. Will that be turned around? Because people haven't really been able to price what's on the exchange.
Well, the idea here was that people would want to know if they're eligible for tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies before they shop, because that gives them the accurate picture of what they're actually paying. So I think the idea was sound, that people go ahead and put in the application, get a determination. But the problem is that was supposed to happen in real time. You weren't supposed to ask for that determination on paper, and then it takes weeks for them to mail a determination back to you. So we just have to concede the fact that the enrollment tool isn't working,
right.
And that's what's creating all these problems. And we need to get the enrollment tool fixed and working.
What are some of the other questions you're getting from consumers?
Oh, we get the whole gamut of questions, and we also we're dealing with a lot of I don't want to say scams, but people who are trying to misdirect consumers and give consumers very bad advice, and we're trying to make sure consumers understand there's only one tool, and that is healthcare.gov for you to go to shop, get the full spectrum of plans available to you, and then access these tax credits and subsidies. So there are other websites being created. But if you shop at those websites, you're not in all likelihood going to be able to access these tax credits to make purchasing insurance more affordable, and you may end up with inferior coverage as well. So we're encouraging people not to be diverted to other websites. I know it's tempting because healthcare.gov isn't working and then other folks are marketing other websites. It's tempting to go to their website, but we encourage you not to. If someone's trying to divert you away from healthcare.gov, it's for a reason, and it's not in your interest to be diverted away from it.
Finally, Don, what do you say to those critics who argue that the healthcare.gov rollout is just one more example, that the Affordable Care Act is a bad law?
Well, we can't confuse a website with the Affordable Care Act. They're not the same thing at all. The Affordable Care Act is a massive law that has been implemented over years. So, for example, young adults under the age 26 could be on their parents' insurance right now. Older Americans in the donut hole are having their prescription drugs subsidized right now because of the Affordable Care Act. So we need to differentiate between a website and the Affordable Care Act, which is doing a lot of good for consumers in a lot of different ways and has been for a number of years. For another example, no child in America can be kicked off their insurance right now due to a pre-existing condition. That's because of the Affordable Care Act. Again, the Affordable Care Act is not a website. Now, when they rolled out Medicare Part D, there were all kinds of problems with that website, too, and it took a while for them to fix all the glitches. So it's not surprising that there were glitches. I think what's surprising is that it's taking longer than anyone expected for them to isolate those glitches and fix them.
Don Hazer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Don Hazer is the director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare. It's one of four navigators in our state for the Affordable Care Act, and we have put links to all four navigators on our website. Go to the stateside link at michiganradio.org. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit may be facing bankruptcy, and it certainly has seen its share of challenges in the past four decades. But all through that time, the city has been home to one of the most vibrant regional opera companies in the nation, the Michigan Opera Theater. The founder of the MOT is Dr. David DeChiara. He was recently named the 2013 Kresge Eminent Artist. That prize is the Kresge Foundation's annual Lifetime Achievement Award in the Arts. It's been called the most prestigious local prize in the field of culture. Dr. DeChiara, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to visit with you by phone.
It has been quite a year. Last February, you announced that you're going to be stepping down from the post of general director of the MOT. You're going to focus on being artistic director for a few more years, and now this Kresge Eminent Artist Award, for which we congratulate you.
Oh, thank you so much. It certainly came as a surprise. I wasn't expecting it, and I'm always used to raising money for the opera company, and when suddenly somebody gives money that's a gift to me, it's kind of like, oh, really? that's a surprise.
When you founded the MOT in 1971, did it seem evident to you that 42 years on, the company would become and would be one of Michigan's cultural treasures?
No, it didn't, of course. I started the company not knowing how successful it would be or unsuccessful. All I knew was that a city of the size and of the importance of Detroit should not be without an opera company, just like all the other major cities in our country. And so I set myself to doing that. I do remember having a fair amount of pushback from people who said, well, you know, this is a blue-collar town, but how could we ever have an opera company? And I simply felt that that one of the challenges we always had in Detroit is that we tended to always think about what we couldn't do rather than what we could do. And so I just simply forged ahead, and I've been very, very grateful to the community and for those who supported my efforts and who believed in the fact that an opera company side by side with a symphony and a museum and all the other cultural institutions should be an important part of the cultural picture.
And these indeed have been very trying years for America's cultural institutions. For example, a sad example, the New York City Opera canceling its season and closing down the company. And that's in New York. So why do you think the MOT is still standing in the bankrupt city of Detroit with what looks like a very secure future?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, you can't use the City Opera as an example because its own circumstances were very unique. I mean, it was sitting across the street or across the plaza from, you know, the largest opera company probably in the world. So that's a very specific kind of a challenge for any company.
But saying that here, as you said, people said Detroit as a blue-collar town, opera, how does that fit? And yet 40-some years later, it has fit.
Well, it has, and because I think, you know, opera is often people think of it as being an elitist form, but it isn't. It's simply the use of the glory of the voice and music to tell a story and to move people with the passion of what music can do. And I think when people try that, when they expose themselves to that, then they realize that opera is just simply a great art form that has given us over 400 years of tremendous legacy, you know. So that's where we, you know, we start. Of course, it's a challenge because our schools are not giving the, you know, arts have taken a very, very side kind of you know, place in the schools. So unlike in decades past when there was music appreciation and all of those things, so it behooves all the cultural institutions to even be more aggressive.
And you have, if you will, pushed the envelope of traditional ways of presenting opera all along to try to reach new audiences. You were a champion of colorblind casting. You produced works that spoke to various ethnic groups. You put subtitles up so the audience can really understand what's going on. And do you feel that that helped keep the MOT alive and thriving?
Well, I think that's key to our success because, you know, Detroit is a very richly diverse city. Of course, it has at least 85% African-Americans, but then we have great Armenian, Polish, Latino, and it is our responsibility to build bridges into those communities. And how do we do that? Well, we make sure that we have things on our stage that reflect their cultures. And from the very beginning, I was committed to making sure that African-American artists were given opportunities to perform and that we also had repertoire that that reflected the African-American experience. I'm proud to say that I believe that as an opera company, we have the largest African-American audience that enjoys and comes to the opera because they feel that it is theirs as well as everybody else's. And I've done the same thing. I've done Armenian operas and Polish operas. And those communities then have come and said, yes, this is our art form too. So it's an ongoing thing. It's not anything you ever say, well, we've done it. Building bridges is something that is just a way of, I think, of life for a cultural institution such as the Michigan Opera Theater.
The founder of the Michigan Opera Theater, Dr. David DiChiara, such a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, too, and thank you for the interview.
It seems that conversations about education in our state generally center on one refrain, STEM. STEM classes, STEM careers. All of that focus on science, technology, engineering, and math seems to have crowded out the arts. Indeed, the Michigan Merit Curriculum now requires only one credit of an arts class for a high school diploma, arguably freeing up students to take more math or science. But a new Michigan State University study may force us to take a fresh look at the value of those arts classes, at the piano lessons, the band practice. Researchers found a startling link between taking part in arts activities as a child with patents received or businesses launched as an adult. And just wait till you hear how STEM graduates are linked to musical training. Joining us now is one of the authors of the study. Rex Lamore directs the MSU Center for Community and Economic Development. Welcome to the program, Rex.
Thank you, Cynthia. Pleasure to be with you today.
And speaking of Cynthia's, it's my pleasure to welcome Cynthia Taggart, who's a professor of music education at Michigan State. Good to have you with us, Cynthia.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Rex, I want to start with your study focusing on this group of MSU Honors College grads who major in STEM subjects. And you looked at a group from 1990 to 1995. What questions were you trying to answer?
Well, we were interested in trying to understand who are the inventive, creative people in our society, those individuals who start innovative businesses or generate innovative patents that result in job creation, business formation, and wealth generation in our communities. And so we looked at these Honors College grads from 90 to 95 who had majored in the science, technology, and engineering, and we had seen from some previous work of one of our colleagues, Dr. Robert Root Bernstein, in physiology, that he had noted through anecdotal studies that highly creative individuals, Nobel Prize laureates, for example, had what he called, they were polymaths. They do many things. They're a scientist and they're a poet. They're an artist and they're a chemist. And so we wanted to see if that dualistic characteristic also played itself out with these groups of highly creative individuals. So we asked them questions: have you started a business? Have you generated a patent? Have you created any other creative activities through articles or books published? And then we asked them their level of participation in arts and crafts throughout their life as children, as young adults, and mature adults.
And what did you find that surprised you the most?
Well, I think what we found that surprised us the most was the role of sustained participation in the arts. In those that were inventors, started a business, generated a patent, we found that they were more likely to have been engaged in the arts through their lifespan. Then we found, of course, that they started as young children, they continued as young adults, and then they continued it in their professional lives. Whereas some of their colleagues who perhaps weren't quite as creative, maybe they started as a child, but they stopped when they went to college. And so this issue of sustained participation as performers or engaged artists seemed to be critical in producing inventors and innovators.
It really struck me as I looked through the study that you found 93% of the STEM graduates had reported musical training as compared to only 34% of average adults. And Cynthia Taggart, you're a longtime music educator, and this study seems to say that unlike the way we approach it, where it seems these days it's either or, either you embrace the STEM path or you're on an arts path, this study seems to say it should be a case of and, STEM and arts.
That's exactly right. And I found it so interesting that the sustained piece was such an important part of Rex's study. For me, it's really compelling that there are some kids who have the potential to be better at the arts than anything else in their lives, and they need that opportunity to study the arts. And to deny them access to that in education is a real travesty. But there are lots of good extrinsic reasons for studying as well, like those that Professor Lamore found.
But we do spend a lot of time, it seems, talking about arts education in terms of how it relates to other fields, like we're doing right now. And you make a good point, Cynthia. We're missing out by not paying attention to arts education for its own sake, aren't we?
Yeah, and in fact, I think a lot of the people who have sort of made the arts their lives find that the intrinsic reasons for studying the arts are the most important, because those are the things that have brought us joy and fulfillment in terms of engaging in the arts, with the arts being sort of a different way of thinking and experiencing and interacting with the world. They're kind of what make us human in a way.
What is happening when, let's say, music becomes a part of a youngster's experience? What actually happens in their brains that gives them that boost in the STEM careers? Do we know that?
We have some information about that in terms of the synaptic connections that get formed in the brain. I think it makes the brain wire in a different way than if they hadn't had those kinds of music engagements. And music engages not just the right side of the brain, as was believed a long time ago, but it really engages the whole brain and in different ways for different kinds of musical engagement.
That was Cynthia Taggart I'm speaking with, a professor of music education at Michigan State University, and she is joined by Rex Lamore from the Faculty of Urban and Regional Planning, who directs the MSU Center for Community and Economic Development. And he was part of a study that found a startling link between being a part in arts and crafts activities as a youngster with patents received or businesses launched as an adult. And Rex, these people who are inventing, who are winning patents, talk to us some more about what they mean for rebuilding our state's economy.
Well, if you think about the implications here, science plus math results in what you might consider a technician. But what we really want, if we're intent on competing in the global economy, we want that inventor, that science plus math plus that creative capacity that generates that new product that, you know, people, the market will beat a path to your door. And they're the job creators, the wealth generators that allow us to enjoy a certain level of quality of life. And so the question is, who are those creators, those inventors, and what are the characteristics of them? So you can go beyond just trying to attract them to your community to perhaps creating them within your community by creating the environment to allow those inventive and creative people to grow and prosper. Then, you know, you're able to create jobs and generate wealth within your community.
Rex, talk to us a little more. I know you say you're looking at having this study out for the economic policymakers to review and study it. What do you hope will happen from the results of this study?
Well, part of what we're wanting to understand is inventive and creative work environments where new ideas and problems are solved. Do they provide opportunities for people to practice their arts and crafts? And, you know, as a simple analogy, many work environments have coffee rooms or break rooms. Might they also have art and creative rooms where workers who are involved in thoughtful and problem-solving activities have a chance to take a break, go paint, play their guitar, practice their poetry, whatever their particular artistic inclinations are, you know, take a break, and then come back to work. We're also looking at the giving of businesses, high growth, high wage, highly competitive businesses. Do they give to the arts, recognizing that many of them may have been participating in the arts as young adults and children, now mature adults? Do they return the gifts back to their community?
Cynthia, the Lansing School District was one of many forced to make drastic cuts in their arts and electives, and I know you were very outspoken about trying to fight to maintain that curriculum for students in Lansing. But here's the question. It costs money to have a school orchestra and to have a band and to offer music lessons as part of a school curriculum. How do you think financially strapped school districts could accomplish this even if they wanted to?
Well, it is a difficult question, and I think that our politicians are going to need to make some tough choices so that the schools in this country have the funding that they need in order to function. But I think the way definitely not to do it is to eliminate some programs and not others. We need to find a balance so that we're really developing the entire person, really in order for our democracy to work. We need to have all types of voices and thinkers at the table. So kind of it's, for me, it's a matter of social justice. The music programs are being eliminated in the school systems that have the students that are coming from the lower socioeconomic statuses, typically urban districts.
Mm-hmm.
And making the problem even worse is that those families also are financially stressed, and so they have the least access to arts instruction outside of the school. They can't afford it. Transportation's a problem. There are fees required to participate. So as a result, the education gap sort of continues to widen between the haves and the have-nots. So it really needs to be part of our school systems. It really needs to be part of education K-12, because that sustained piece of it is so important.
That was Cynthia Taggart. She's a professor of music education at Michigan State University, and she was joined by Rex Lamore, who's with the Faculty of Urban and Regional Planning, and he directs the MSU Center for Community and Economic Development. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us and giving us a lot to think about with arts education.
Thank you,
Cynthia.
Thank you.
Still to come. Well, we all know Detroit is broke, and any day now, Judge Stephen Rhodes will decide if the city is eligible for bankruptcy protection. But what will it take to keep other cities and towns across Michigan safe from municipal bankruptcy? That story comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Word is one of the top aides to Governor Rick Snyder recently remarked to a colleague that the adults are now running things at Detroit City Hall. Now, does that comment point to a better working relationship between the governor, emergency manager Kevin Orr, and the incoming mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been parsing the things that are being said by all parties, seeking signs of which way the wind is blowing. Daniel, it's been a little more than 2 weeks now since Mike Duggan won what could well be dubbed one of the most difficult, challenging elected positions in the state. And we certainly know relations between Kevin Orr and Mayor Dave Bing have been frosty. What signs are you seeing that there could be a better working relationship with Mayor-elect Duggan?
Well, I think the signs are all very positive. This week, Mike Duggan came to the Detroit News Public Policy Forum that we hosted at Wayne State. And he was very careful to, number one, not disparage the relationship or the talks or to prejudge them. And they're having them every Thursday. There's a dinner this evening between the two men where they're going to continue their conversations, which are essentially power-sharing discussions. I think it's very clear that they are trying to find a way to make this work. Clearly, Mike Duggan wants as much of the operational control of the city as he can get come January 1st. There are some things that he's not going to get. One of the things that he is learning is that the bankruptcy exacts a discipline of its own on this entire process. So it's a very complicated relationship, but it's important to note that Mike Duggan and Kevin Orr were law school classmates at the University of Michigan. And right before the election, a person by the name of Stacy Fox, who was a very good friend of Kevin Orr's from Michigan Law School, was made the deputy emergency manager and effectively his chief of staff. And she also has a very good working relationship with Mike Duggan from previous iterations of Mike's career. So I think this is very intentional to try and improve the prospects of this working, get them on the same page, recognizing that at the end of the day, until Kevin Orr leaves as emergency manager, he is effectively the CEO of the city, and the best that the elected mayor is going to be like a chief operating officer, and under any kind of arrangement like that, the COO to some extent has to serve under the rubric of the CEO.
We should also toss in the fact that Rick Snyder is Michigan Law School, so they all kind of are from the same petri dish, if we will.
there's no question about it. I mean, that's kind of one of the ties that binds all of this, and it's, I think, very interesting. But the important part about that is I think that there is, across all these different offices, if you will, there's a lot of mutual respect. I mean, Duggan is getting to know Orr at this point, and Orr is getting to know Duggan. And I think that both of these guys are looking at the other guy and saying, this guy's pretty smart. From what I understand, they start to address issues, and they start at very different ends of the spectrum. But they tend to get very creative, and they tend to find a lot of agreement on things.
And you point out in your column today, Daniel, that Orr really needs Duggan's skill set, but you also point out that Governor Snyder needs Duggan there playing a significant role in running the city. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's true. Put this in context. I mean, Kevin Orr, by all intents and purposes, is probably going to be gone by this time next year. City Council more than likely will vote, 2/3 vote, to have him disappear, and that will be in the middle of a gubernatorial campaign. There's no question but what the governor, if he had his druthers, would not appoint another emergency manager to replace Kevin Orr. The hope is that this bankruptcy and their financial restructuring is pretty much done by that time. He can then leave, and then the operational restructuring of the city can be left to the mayor and a new council. So I think he's really hoping that Mike Duggan is successful and that these two guys are successful in putting together an operational agreement so that he can actually get some things done. Because the longer this goes on, the more contentious I think it potentially becomes and more problematic it can become for the governor.
What leverage do you think Duggan has as he dialogues with Rick Snyder and Kevin Orr, staking out his ground, if you will?
Well, I think the leverage is essentially, I can help you here. This is what I do, and I can help you if you let me, and if you're willing to give me some room to run. If you're not, you know, you've got a situation where Kevin Orr isn't, he is not an expert in running a city. When he was asked at the Detroit Economic Club last month, you know, what job did he least want, he said mayor.
Hmm.
I mean, that's not his thing,
yeah.
And this is not what he's about doing. And up to now, the process has been very focused on the financial restructuring, not on the operational side, and they need more help. He doesn't have enough staff. The current department heads and everything else are loyalists or were appointed by Mayor Dave Bing, who clearly is a lame duck. So that team is really not involved and really focused on an operational restructuring, which is clearly what Mike Duggan wants to do. He said at Wayne State at our forum a couple nights ago that, you know, you have to understand how these organisms work, and they're all interdependent. If you want to fix and hire people at the fire department, you have to recognize that you've got a broken HR department, you've got a problem with IT, your vehicle maintenance, which was privatized, the private company isn't doing the job any better than the city government was doing it before them, and you need the ability to deal with all those constituent pieces. So it's very complicated, and the Bing administration has not done a lot of that, and Kevin Orr doesn't have the people and the ability to do that right now, so that's why he needs Duggan. And I think that's, in many ways, what his leverage really is.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes' piece in the news today, Time's Right for Duggan to Share Reins. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
More and more, cities and states across the country are realizing they, too, face the same challenges that brought Detroit to its knees. The promises made to the municipal workers in terms of pensions that are becoming too much for many cities and states to bear. And yet, the law tells mayors and governors, you must keep those pension plans intact. And as pension costs mount, they try raising taxes or turning to the municipal bond market. And when those doors are slammed shut, what happens? Essential services get cut, pink slips start flying, and disgusted businesses and homeowners get out of town. And that leaves a smaller and poorer population behind, even less able to cover a city's soaring cost. That is the death spiral. My next guest believes he has a solution. James Spiotto is a municipal bankruptcy expert and a partner with Chapman & Cutler in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
As you've seen Detroit's troubles unfold, Jim, does it strike you that it really stands as a textbook case of a municipal death spiral?
Well, it certainly demonstrates that if you don't, because of the need to use funds elsewhere, reinvest in your infrastructure, in your essential governmental services, you lose the population, business, and taxpayers that you need to have sufficient revenues to make pensions and other obligations sustainable and affordable. And so the long, unfortunate history of Detroit in not making those payments and losing population sort of demonstrates the need to address it soon and address it effectively.
And as you look across the national landscape, does it strike you that there are more big city failures that are not too far down the road if things don't change?
Well, I mean, Detroit is a wonderful opportunity to give an example of turning it around, having a recovery plan that reinvests and allows those obligations to be paid over time based on amount that is sustainable and affordable. What every city recognizes is that they have a central mission to provide essential services to their citizens. At the same time, there's promises that have been made in good faith in the hopes that there'll be revenues there, and unfortunately, the erosion of population and business in some of these situations have left the municipalities with less of a tax base and less of ability to pay. And so what I think we have an opportunity for is an ability to address what can we pay without crowding out essential services and infrastructure investments, because we know if we do that, we're only going to wind up with less revenues because we have less taxpayers, businesses, and individuals. That's not the goal of any municipality.
I'm speaking with James Spiotto, who's a municipal bankruptcy expert and a partner with Chapman & Cutler in Chicago. And he believes that he has a solution to this death spiral cities like Detroit are in. And you call this the Public Pension Funding Authority. Just what is it?
It would be an authority that would help everyone, the citizens, the municipality, its elected officials, the workers, the union representatives, to address the issue, what is sustainable and affordable? Because it is in each one of those interests that they get this right. if you crowd out essential governmental services, you're only going to have less to pay workers, retirees, creditors, and you can't raise taxes to the sky because, as we know, as you raise taxes beyond the level that is sustainable, you're going to lose taxpayers. That's been the history in a number of locations. And when you lose taxpayers, you start that death spiral. So the important thing is to have an authority that has got an objective, independent, expert group that will help determine and will provide expert opinion and advice to what is sustainable and affordable. They'll look at the projected revenues, they'll look at the projected expenses, and they'll say, this is how much we can spend without crowding out essential services. It will then allow the municipality and its various constituents to hopefully come up with a recovery plan that will match that. And if, unfortunately, they're not able to do that, they will then have to live with the determination that this is what is sustainable and affordable, so that the next steps, which are, you know, could be a number of different steps, will at least take out of the fight what can be paid for and what must be paid for, i.e. the reinvestment in the city, the essential governmental services, and the infrastructure. Because, again, and this can't be emphasized too much, without paying those, the amount of money you can pay for pensions, for workers, or for anything goes down.
When you talk about the Public Pension Funding Authority, this idea, so it would be independent, and is it quasi-judicial, so it could hand down orders and things would have to happen?
Right. It would, in the first phase, it would make a determination to allow people the opportunity to do it the right way, come together in a buy-in situation. If not, it can make a determination and come up with what is an appropriate recovery plan initially proposed by the city and is adjusted by those determinations. And it would, you know, have the ability to have those determinations enforced for the sake of all. Because, again, if you don't fund what you need to fund to keep the city going, the investment in the city, you only wind up with less. And that is very important to everybody. And unfortunately, we start out crowding out essential governmental services and infrastructure and then paying the price later.
How does this differ from an emergency manager? Because we've seen this in Detroit where the EM came in, determined what needed to be done, had some discussions with all parties. Now, it depends on what side of the fence you're on as to whether it was good faith and it was enough, then determined what needed to be done and kind of followed that same path. But it's not the same as an EM?
It's more like the Municipal Assistance Corp for New York City, and financial control boards in the state of New York, or refinance authorities in New Jersey, some of the things that were done in Pennsylvania. The plan is developed by the municipality. The information starts from the municipality with the right of the other constituents, workers and union representatives, to comment on what is the revenues stream, what is the expenses, and what is sustainable and affordable. If people can't voluntarily, after those determinations are made, come up with something, then it is the municipality and its elected officials who start with a recovery plan that will be commented upon by the other constituents. And after that comment period or hearing on it, then it's up to the authority to either approve it or to suggest modifications to it based upon what is sustainable and affordable. Since pensions are long-term obligations, the most important thing is to make sure that what you're funding is sustainable and affordable, because long-term, you know, if you pay it, what do the problems of the past tell us? It was the pension holidays. It was making promises for things that weren't sustainable and affordable that got us into this.
Mm-hmm.
What this does is, going forward, every annual payment of pension obligations would have a dedicated tax source to it, so there wouldn't be any pension holidays. Secondly, you don't add to anything unless you have dedicated revenues to pay it. And on a periodic basis, as you implement your recovery plan and do better, then there is a reassessment of this, so that if you can pay more, you then will pay more, so that you maintain everything as sustainable and affordable. You provide the assurance to the workers and to the retirees that as much that can be paid without sacrificing the future of the city and their future, because that's their funding source, will be paid to them. And it may take the current underfunding and break it into that which is going to be paid as part of the sustainable and affordable, and that which is a contingent payment or a future payment that will come as the recovery plan is implemented and as they do better. And as you invest in the community, you invest in new jobs for your citizens, those are the new taxpayers. You have more revenue to pay these obligations.
So the idea would be to get workers and citizens both on the same page, because right now it seems if one side scores a win, it's at the expense of the other side.
Correct. This is we are all in it together situation. This is not if I win. For example, if the workers win and crowd out essential governmental services and infrastructure, they actually lose.
Mm-hmm.
If citizens win and cram down the payments to workers and unions beyond that which you need to be sustainable and affordable, you'll have less inspired, motivated workers who are necessary to have the recovery plan work. So all sides need each other.
And what kind of price, as you look down the road, do you see us paying as a nation if we don't come up with a way that is sustainable and affordable for cities and states to meet pension obligations?
Well, the unfortunate thing is the underfunding hole only gets bigger. And it gets bigger because you don't have those funds invested to earn money, which pension funds do, and you don't have the motivation and factor of bringing people together and say, we're going to focus on the recovery plan. We're going to turn our city around, and we're going to make sure we attract business. Instead, you sit there fighting and arguing and debating over less and less and accomplishing exactly the opposite of what you want to accomplish.
James Spiato is a municipal bankruptcy expert and a partner with Chapman and Cutler in Chicago. Mr. Spiato, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside today.
My pleasure.
And let's wrap up this week of Stateside by inviting you to let us know what's on your mind. What stories are you most interested in? Who should we profile on Stateside? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and, of course, at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. And that's our show for this Thursday. Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.